Hi, I'm James Esposito, and this is New Books in History. I recently spoke to Keith Hillsbury about his new book, Empire Made, My Search for an Outlaw Uncle Who Vanished in British India. Empire Made was published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt in 2017. Hillsbury's Empire Made explores the mystery behind Nadir Halik, a former colonial bureaucrat and employee of the British East India Company. Hillsbury starts with his own travels in India and his quest to find the grave of his relative who vanished. Hillsbury follows Halleck's trail through family letters, Napoli's archives, and his own contacts in the area, slowly reconstructing the life of the most interesting and unconventional man. Halleck challenged the taboos of race and sexuality in the British Empire while fashioning his own identity in the remote region of Nepal. It was a pleasure to talk to Keith, and I hope you enjoy the show. Hi, Keith. Welcome to the show.
Hi, James. Thanks for having me.
So, Keith, we're talking about your new book, Empire Made, My Search for an Outlaw Uncle Who Vanished in British India. And first off, as is typical with new books, tell me how this book came to be. What made you want to write about history? And specifically in this book, as a sort of part memoir, part family history, what made you want to write about it in the way that you did?
The original idea for the book was more of a travel story. I was in the MFA program at Columbia University, and I took a wonderful seminar on travel writing from Nicholas Christopher. And the written work at the end of the term was to do a book proposal. I proposed a book about my travels in Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, and living in Nepal. A little bit of that book proposal touched on this quest for my mother's, long lost relative. And Nick Christopher, my teacher, liked the proposal so much that, and he knew I had an agent. He knew I'd published books before, obviously. And he said, you really should develop this and give it to your agent and sell it. You know, I think you can make a book out of this. And I stopped a novel I was working on and took his advice. And my agent really thought the Nigel story, the looking for the grave of the long lost relative, was the real story. She thought it was more interesting than my travel. So I kind of resisted it at first, but I started doing more research into the circumstances of his life in the with the East India Company. And I got more and more interested in it, and because I found more and more things that were at odds with my assumptions about the colonial life and the people that were colonialists. I thought they were all really bad. You know, it was a terrible thing. You know, there wasn't any good that could have come of this, and that the people were scoundrels. And I started finding out that many of those people were actually rebels. The people that were running India from time to time were pretty rebellious and pretty modern in their attitudes in some ways. And so I was drawn into this story by learning that some of the people I could be writing about and researching were actually people that I could identify with in my own sort of rebellious, contrarian nature.
Okay. Yeah. Your book focuses on trying to find the grave of your ancestor, Nigel Halik. And you have this interesting parallel narrative structure where you talk about visiting Pakistan, Afghanistan, and northern India in the 1970s and 1980s, but you're also trying to retrace his steps through letters. And can you talk to me a little bit about where these letters came from and why there is sort of the sparse paper trail that you have to sort of construct around this in your narrative?
There are only a few letters left that have been passed down, the generations. And for whatever reasons, I mean, I think the main reason was that most of them were probably kept, but in Coventry in England, where the family lived, had always lived. In 1940, the German, the Nazis bombed the city and destroyed much of the city and destroyed the house that most of these letters were kept in. And so there were some fragments of letters that had been kept somewhere else, I believe. And And what was tricky about it was they were just a few pages here and there, and most of them were saved because they made reference to a historical figure, John Nicholson, who had become a hero of the British Empire after at the time of the Indian Mutiny in 1857. And he became, you know, a real hero that everyone knew about. There were boys' books about him and comic books, and, you know, he was this stunning guy. And some of the later family members looking through these old letters evidently figured out that it was this well-known guy. And so they underscored his name, and they threw away probably the rest of the letters and kept them just because of historical value and, you know, the sort of celebrity status of him. But there were really just a few, I think there was no more than probably about 20, 25 sheets of paper from, you know, a period spanning about 11 years. And, you know, they had little indicators of where they were written sometimes, and you could get context from them, but there was no paper trail. You know, there was no collected letters of Nigel Halleck that you could just refer to and organize by date. You sort of had to do a lot of detective work from the context and knowing where he was at different times to figure out exactly where he was when he wrote them and who he was talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no. One of the best parts about this book is the mystery. You know, I'm going through the pages and I'm trying to figure out where's Keith going with this? Where does Nigel end up? And it's really, really compelling. We were talking about this earlier. Is what would you describe this book? You call it a quest, but I would also call it an imperial history, a gay history as well, and really also memoir and travel book. How would you define your work with Empire Made?
I think it's a travel detective story. It's sort of I wrote the book more and more as internally as a detective story, because it was taking clues both from contemporary times and mostly from Victorian times, massing them together, searching for little pieces of meaning and connections and trying to make those connections, all the while being a character in it myself, essentially, you know. So it's sort of an interactive detective story in my mind. But it was a quest, you know, and it was a quest to discover a little piece of history, you know, that was unexpected. You know, a relationship between two men, different cultures, different religions, you know, completely different backgrounds, that, you know, was not the kind of story that, even if they were known at the time, that people talked about or wrote about. So there was like a veil, so to speak, over everything, you know, and especially that relationship, and to kind of make the connections was a detective thing. You know, I keep coming back to that, I guess, because I like to read detective stories in my leisure time.
Well, I mean, maybe we can talk about that. I mean, you're the second novelist turned historian that I've interviewed, first being Norman Olher with Blitzed. And how do you think that your previous work as a novelist informed this book? Did you have to do more research, do you think, or was the construction of the book, was it more intensive, or you know, did you have to learn a lot about the British Empire to sort of approach it the way that you did?
Oh, James, it was a hell of a lot more work than writing novels, I'm telling you. I mean, both of the novels I published, much of the stuff was based on personal experiences. It is with a lot of first and second time novelists, and you know, I would do a little research here and there to firm up some specific facts, but this was going out and educating myself for several years once the book started, the writing process about the British Empire, doing archival research, doing a lot of research at Columbia University Library, at the New York Public Library, online through the British Library, the India Collection, lots of digital, you know, online research of correspondence by Victorian people in India. There was a whole research component of it that was a big job, because I went into this thinking, oh, well, I'll just, there's you know, going to be a book or two that tell me all about the British East India Company and get me up to speed. There isn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. You find the joys and perils of what historians call historiography. Historians rarely exactly. agree on stuff. And then the stuff that they agree on is, you know, always sort of has a shelf life. That's really interesting coming that from an MFA. Was that daunting to sort of take on all this, these sort of historians that are sort of, you know, disagreeing or sort of have different interpretations of empire and what it meant to be in the British Empire in the 19th century?
I encountered so much conflicting information about even basic facts that I was really surprised. But I think the real moment for me when I actually felt like I was becoming a historian myself, although of course not a trained one, was when I was able to start making judgments about some of the respected people in the field when I felt like I was catching them out, you know, like mm-hmm. when I felt like I actually knew more about some specific little thing, for John Nicholson's Christian beliefs, for example, than people who were trained historians who were publishing and making statements. And there was a point where I thought, no, you're wrong.
There's this.
I've got proof. And of course, I'm not going to take anyone to task in print, but you know, there were a couple of moments like that. And it was kind of exciting actually, because I really felt like all this digging and cross-checking it was paying off, that, you know, because I was so focused on this little tiny part of the imperial history that I was able to dig deep enough where I felt like an expert on it to the, you know, more so than some of the people who are acknowledged. And, you know, I'm not being arrogant about that. I mean, I'm sure there's plenty of mistakes in my work, but it was exciting to feel that it was a detective story that was, you know, coming up with the answers and definitive answers. And that's what history should be about, I think. And I don't claim to have a monopoly on them on this topic, but by any means, but about some specific things, I feel like I probably know more about this than most people. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. No. Please go on, Keith.
Well, the thing is that I think the difficulty I had as a novelist, though, I think the advantages of being a novelist were being able to think in terms of characterization and developing the personal sides of people more than probably just an academic historian would feel comfortable trying to do. But the difficulty for me was making the leap of feeling confident enough to make judgments about things that I wasn't 100% sure about. And what really helped me in that regard was a fellowship I had with Brenda Wineapple, the author Brenda Wineapple. I was a research assistant for her on her book about Emily Dickinson and Thomas Wentworth Higginson. And we talked about this, and, you know, because she was trying to, there's very little, Emily Dickinson's letters had all been burned, mostly. But Wentworth Higginson's had plenty of material on him, but the book was about their interaction, and a lot of assumptions had to be made or tested based really just on general knowledge, not specific knowledge. And you know, she helped persuade me that, you know, when you do enough research and you feel like you can get inside the head of someone like Emily Dickinson on some certain things, that you have authority because you've done everything you can. You're inhabiting their mind in a way. And if you do enough research and have a broad enough vision of the context of the time and the people, you shouldn't be shy about making assumptions and deciding what their emotional state probably was. And for me, that was difficult because I was drawing a line between fiction and nonfiction, and it was in my mind originally. And it was like, if I don't have definitive authority on this, I'm not going to make any assumptions about what Nigel's thinking was or his feelings were. But looking back on the time working with Brenda and some of the lessons I learned helping her think about Emily Dickinson, it helped a lot, because I reached that point, as I said, you know, with a minute ago, about feeling that I had more knowledge than most people about some things. And then it was okay. Like, Yeah, he probably did feel this way. And I feel pretty confident in saying this is what happened. But it was a learning curve. I was really hesitant to make judgments about people that lived in a different time and had a different background and a whole different context of living. But you have to if you're setting yourself in that time as an observer, I mean, which essentially I was.
Yeah, no, I think this is a good way to segue into the first part of the book. I mean, if you could just talk to us a little bit about Nigel and the world Nigel inhabited and why he decided to join the company and go to India. I mean, you talk about this a little bit. Also, this is sort of a really dynamic time. This is the time before communications are, you know, modern telecommunications are available. So people in the company and this sort of imperial mentality sort of leads to sort of a little bit of rogueness or at least agency on the characters, including the Lawrence brothers and Nicholson. Can you talk to me about that? And like, how did you approach the fact that Nigel didn't live in a world of instantaneous communication? He had to sort of accept that he was going on his own and he had to figure out his own way in this world that was foreign to him, but became increasingly familiar linguistically, but also I think culturally.
I think, you know, backing up a little bit there, I think it's useful to think of this time for the British in India as analogous to the Americans in the Gold Rush era going west, that there was all this opportunity out there for a generation of people that didn't exist at home. And in the case of England, and in the case of the middle class Englishman who didn't have a lot of prospects, other than maintaining, you know, himself in the middle class, that India was exactly the same as the California Gold Rush was for someone of the same class and age at the same time in America. But it meant casting off everything that was familiar in both cases. And what the British tried to do in India that was different, obviously, than what the Americans tried to do was the Americans were settling, you know, the West. That India was already settled and you know, occupied by hundreds of millions of people. The British really didn't intend to stay, whereas the Americans did. And so the British had to construct a society that was British, but completely insular. Mm-hmm. And the difficulty for Nigel and all the rest of these people was that it was really a pretty small society and a confining society. You know, Calcutta, the number of English people in Calcutta at the height of its glory as the capital of the British Indian Empire was just, you know, 3,000 Englishmen or something like that. I mean, there weren't, it was a very small, it was like a high school, a big American high school. And all the social cliques, you know, that you have, you know, were there too in different forms, you know, and the military people didn't really mix with the civilian administrators very much. And it was even discouraged. The main military base was outside of Calcutta on purpose to keep the military, you know, the soldiery especially, but the officers as well, from being too involved with the civil administrators. So, you know, he went out to India and, you know, he was on his own. There wasn't, you know, it took months for letters to get home. There was no telegraph at the time. You really were cut off from any kind of meaningful interaction with people that the familiar people you knew, your family, anyone else. And yet you were placed in this very insular society where you really had to watch what you were doing and to get ahead. And you had to do certain things, you had to get involved in certain sports, you had to go to certain houses, you had to have the introductions to the right people, and then you went to the races, and then you went to the fancy dress balls. And, you know, it was very rigorously organized. And for someone like Nigel, and for other people too, like Henry Lawrence, for example, whom you mentioned, you know, the, who became his mentor there, this didn't really fit very well with their personalities. They were adventurous types of people, or in the case of Lawrence, they were really nonconformists. I mean, he had very advanced views about race and things like that compared to his contemporaries, and he wasn't willing to put up with a lot of the stultifying racism and prejudice, the overt prejudice of the ruling class there. And that marked him as someone who didn't fit in. So they were out of touch with progressive people at home, of which there were, you know, in England. I mean, there was a progressive movement at the time. There were people that didn't believe in the imperial idea, but they were not people that, you know, people like Nigel knew or were in touch with, or the Lawrence family were in touch with. I mean, they were on their own, and they kind of had to make it up as they went along. And Nigel's career in India was a process of distancing himself steadily from the accepted ideas about what the British were doing and what they meant to the Indian people. And the longer he was there, the more alienated he became from the idea that the British were a master race and they were there for the good of the Indian people. And it was pretty much on his own. And then he met Henry Lawrence and read the articles he'd been publishing in a journal that was meant for educated Indians in Bengali. And he found someone who helped crystallize his thinking, and he went to work for him. He volunteered his services, you know, threw away chances of advancement in Calcutta, you know, and climbing the ladder to get a good position that would pay him a lot of money and give him a higher social status. He went out into the sticks because he really felt that he still believed he was doing something good, you know, I think in his career by working for the company. But he saw Lawrence as someone, once he went away from Calcutta, that was had a higher mission, and that he could feel good about being involved in the colonial enterprise. He went out there as a naive young man, and it was a process, a learning process. And so he had a quest for his own, I think, peace of mind. That's my impression. I mean, it's something that's hinted at in the fragments of letters more than explicitly stated. But the more I looked into his circumstances, the more I found out about his journey, the more confident I was that he was someone who wanted to do good and found that the best way of doing good was to get as far away from the do-gooders as possible.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, also, I think that there is this sort of trend in Nigel's journey that you know, he tries to get away from the sort of high Victorian rules with gender and sexuality. He tries to get as far away from them as he possibly can. I mean, he sort of does what he needs to do in terms of his job. I mean, he takes up jobs as a tax assessor, but he gets farther and farther away from this sort of hub of, you know, high Victorian culture, and he sort of finds himself on the sort of fringes of empire, and he constructs it almost like a new identity. Like, you've been to these parts of the world. Did you feel like when you were in, you know, remote parts of northern India or in Pakistan or Kashmir or wherever, did you feel like that you found a certain affinity with Nigel's ambition to sort of go far?
Especially in Afghanistan and the northwest frontier parts of Pakistan, I don't think things have changed much in the mindset of the tribal areas and from the time that he was there. And I think we have new players in the sort of organization of things, the Taliban, obviously, and you know, radical Islamic thought. But the people themselves are very similar in their cultural makeup to what they were at the time of Nigel's life there. And I know that traveling down the Indus with my Pakistani friend, and was a real experience of immersion in what seemed to be another time. Because once you got away from the highways and the buses and the, you know, the schools, and you were on the river and you were just these little river settlements that were very similar to what they would have been when John Nicholson and Herbert Edwards went down the river in 1851, you know, except for an odd power line and a little bit of electricity here and there and a phone line, and things were, they seemed to be in 1850. I mean, the pace of life, the men hanging around in the shade, smoking hand-rolled cigarettes and leering at these young boys. You know, I mean, it was really an immersion in a lot of the stuff I read about, you know, is happening in that period way back when. It felt like nothing had really changed. And, you know, it was really interesting. And it was also, you couldn't help but think about, you know, the similarities between what the young men of Henry Lawrence, that Henry Lawrence had go out to the frontier to try to settle these people down, faced this kind of counterinsurgency idea that is now happening in the same area, you know, with different people running it. The idea that you've got to get these people involved in buying into the fact that it's their country, and if they behave themselves, they can keep it. But if they don't behave themselves, they're going to be in trouble. It's a very similar situation, you know, very similar.
Yeah, no, there is this idea of sort of nation building and nationness and making, you know, codifying rules about sexuality and marriage and the role of man and the role of woman in this sorts of in these sorts of places that would not be, I think you're right. I don't think that they're so disparate. I think the players, like you say, the players have changed. So much of this book is about empires, you know. In the middle part of your book, when Nigel gets to Nepal, you're in that area as well, and you sort of encounter a Russian emigre named Boris, who is this sort of, you know, he is the remnants of this great game scenario that goes back through the 19th century, where the British and the Russians sort of meet in this strategically important but also incredibly distant and hard to access area. Can you talk about the Nepal aspect of this? Because the most interesting part of the middle of the book is you're talking about how Nigel was one of the first people that was actually, or first Europeans that were actually there, and how you found out about that and how you constructed that.
Well, I knew he'd been to Nepal, but what I didn't know until I did a lot of research was how few Europeans had actually been there at the time that he went there. Really, there had just been a few exploratory people in the early part of the 19th century, and then the British imposed a resident on the Nepalese monarchy where an Englishman and a surgeon and, you know, I think a secretary were allowed to live there. But it was starting around 1811 or 12, but it was, I believe, but it was, otherwise the country was completely shut off. I think I say in the book, there was nothing ambiguous about Nepalese foreign policy. It consisted of keeping foreigners out of the country. they had, and barring any contact with foreigners, because they were very afraid in Nepal, the rulers of Nepal, of coming under the British thumb. They had the geographic advantage of this almost impenetrable jungle along the entire border with India that was full of malaria for much of the year, a really debilitating form of malaria that was inhabited by tigers and, you know, snakes and every horrible thing you can think of, and which had stymied in the past, you know, Indian empire builders, the native Indian empire builders, they had stopped at this jungle, the Terai jungle. They had the Himalayas on the other side of the country, keeping the Tibetans at bay. They were geographically blessed, but as technology advanced and as the British became more and more entrenched in India, you know, they were worried that if they allowed any kind of commerce, any kind of visitation to happen, that, you know, the next thing you know, the Union Jack is flying over the, you know, the temples of Kathmandu. So they were very determined to keep the British at bay. But they were also a fairly martial people, though, that enjoyed taking over one another's valleys and areas of Nepal. And eventually, rulers of Nepal decided to take over parts of British India that were, you know, nearby, and tried it out and got beaten back. But they didn't get beaten back very, very severely, because they were really good soldiers. And the British recognized this, and they decided that to try to take over, to punish Nepal for invading and taking a few farms here and there, was silly, and that they would end up, you know, with this immense army trying to hold on to what they clawed back. So they established sort of a modus operandi with the Nepalese, which is that the Nepalese would behave themselves. They would accept British hegemony, essentially, but the British would leave it at that. And because really Nepal didn't have a lot of resources, it didn't have, you know, riches, you know, it wasn't like India. So the British, as long as they felt they were running the show, if the worst came to worst, they were fine. What happened is that an ambitious Nepali decided that he wanted to throw over the monarchy and institute his own family as the real rulers of Nepal. And he decided the best way to do this was to get the British involved secretly, to some extent, in approving of what he was doing. And his name was Jung Bahadur Rana. And he, through incredible deceit and cunning and, you know, just amazingly crafty maneuvering, managed to, within about 3 or 4 years, insinuate himself into the ruling class. He was a cavalryman. Make friends with the queen, who he then betrayed, and take over the country. And where this fits into the Nigel thing is that when Jung Bahadur Rana took over, he had Henry Lawrence, the British agent, the British resident, as someone who'd been giving him advice all the way through about how he should proceed, and, you know, how he should present himself, and how he should implicitly placate the British if he succeeded in what he wanted to do. And he took over the country. It worked. Lawrence was gone by then, but he had recognized. Jung Bahadur had recognized that to be in touch with the British and to have the British on his side was the best way to keep himself in power, and the best way for Nepal to remain independent. And so when someone like Nigel came along as a prospective guest, you know, and a visitor that wanted to stay in the country, from Jung Bahadur's perspective, he was someone who could prove useful. And it seems, and then we enter the realm of supposition here, because, you know, you never know what really happened, but Nigel's arrival certainly did present an opportunity for Jung Bahadur to curry favor with people like Henry Lawrence, who were no longer in Nepal, but were heavily involved in the direction of the British administration in India. And it seems that it was a British idea that Jung Bahadur go to England himself, mm-hmm. and plead his case with Queen Victoria, essentially. It was an idea that was really revolutionary. None of these princes or these maharajas or these subsidiary areas of India had ever taken the initiative to actually go to England and present themselves to the Queen, whom they were ostensibly, you know, serving and or ostensibly allying themselves with. There were lots of reasons for not doing that, but no one ever did. So Jung Bahadur decided to throw the dice and leave Nepal and go to England. And Nigel went at the same time. Now, there's no documentary evidence that Nigel encouraged Jung Bahadur, but it seems pretty likely. and given connections that he had with Henry Lawrence and Henry Lawrence's determination to keep Nepal independent, as well as the Punjab, he didn't believe in. Henry Lawrence did not believe India should annex any more the British India should annex any more territory. He thought the Punjab should be independent. He thought Nepal should stay independent. And at the time, his ideas were shared by the rulers of India. But over time, politics changed in England, and Henry Lawrence's views fell out of favor. So it was sort of, by that point, it was sort of a backdoor thing. Lawrence was getting interested in Jung Bahadur as someone who could go to the Queen, who could go to England, present himself as this, noble, strong, reasonable man who ought to be able to keep his country independent as long as he didn't interfere with the British larger geopolitical objectives. And Nigel went to England, back to England at the same time. And the only city that, beside London, that Jung Bahadur visited on his trip just happened to be Coventry, where Nigel was from. I think that it's one of those things, like I said, there's no proof, but, I think I can feel pretty confident in saying that Nigel has something to do with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that makes sense. And you note in your book that Nigel never returns. He has sort of this brief visit with his family, and the letters stop coming. It wasn't clear in the book that I saw, when the letters actually stopped. Did he send many letters after he returned to India from Coventry, or did they really just stop pretty quickly after that?
The family legend was that they pretty much stopped.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it was just a case of they were lost and they were written. It seems to be a case. My guess is that when he went back to England, he realized that his thinking about things and his whole life, by then he was romantically involved with this Afghan prince. I think that when he went back to England, he may have harbored the idea that he could go back there with his companion, to England and return to living in, an English life. And I think my guess is that when he went back there, he realized not only was that not on the cards, but that it's not even something he really wanted to do, that he had become, the Chetnification is the phrase used by a modern historian about this, some of the English became Indianized, and to the point where they didn't want it, that they didn't fit in England anymore. And they didn't completely fit in India, but they felt more comfortable there. And I think he'd reached that point, especially with this relationship that he had with the Afghan prince. And I think he'd arrived in India years before feeling extremely alienated. Now he went back to England and he felt even more alienated than in England than he felt when he came to India originally.
That's one of these paradoxes of empire. And I think that you do a great job in your book to sort of think about that and how alienating going back to England in the Victorian age with a partner of the same sex as being it would be like being on a different planet. I think that you might even quote it that way. I mean, just so radically different. To be almost like incomprehensible.
I think he probably felt that he'd crossed the 2 or 3 years before when he'd crossed that black, foul-smelling creek and entered the forbidden territory of Nepal. I think that probably, but when he went to England a couple of years later, he probably looked back on that as crossing, his own Rubicon, in a sense that when he made that crossing unknowingly, he'd sort of gone off the edge of the ability to return. You can't go home again. I think that he probably realized when he went back to England that he'd become, you have to on the practical level, you have to think, too, he was living in a splendor compared to anything he could possibly live in England, you know, with all these servants and all these, you know, lavish surroundings of this palace that he was a guest in. And, you know, that's part of it, too. Let's be honest. I mean, it was one of the reasons that so many of the British middle class loved being colonials, is they had all these servants and they had much nicer homes than they would have had ever had in England. And you know, these sort of upper class pastimes and playing polo and race horses and all this that they couldn't have afforded at home. And, you know, Nigel was living in, you know, in a very poor country, Nepal, but he was living in the home of the ruler of the country, a very rich man, and with all these servants and, you know, this beautiful surroundings and artwork and jewels and all this. And he was an artistic fellow. He had aesthetic appreciation, and I'm sure Coventry looked pretty dismal. You know, I think there's that undoubtedly part of it too, is that he had a real aesthetic side to him, and he was really interested in art and architecture and all this. And, you know, he could really get into that in a style in India and Nepal that was impossible for someone of his class in England. So it was a combination of things, but I think probably the relationship was the big thing, you know, and also, you know, the racism. I mean, let's be honest here. Like, it wasn't just that he had a male companion. He had a Muslim, you know, Afghan, you know, and who was despite the fact that he was of royal blood, and I mean, had an incredible pedigree compared to probably most of the titled people of England that were out in India, that didn't matter. I mean, he would come to England and he would be regarded as a second class at best, you know, person. And that must, you know, I'm sure that was just impossible to envision for Nigel, because he was not, I think by our standards today, most people at that time, Henry Lawrence included, were racist, but by the standards of the day, he was definitely not a racist and was very progressive in his thinking and about those matters, obviously. And, you know, people had ingrained attitudes that, you know, were those of the Victorian era, but Nigel really was not someone who could have comfortably gone back to England with his partner and felt that it was okay for him to be treated as he would be treated, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about, in the book, you have this really interesting section when you go to Nepal and you're trying to find the archive. You're trying to access some of this 19th century, the logs for the people staying at the palace. And can you talk about that? Because it is like a good lesson for archivists and just people that have to deal with records in general, is that the archive you go to is just covered in snails. can you talk about what it was like to actually do research under those conditions in the early 1980s?
Well, you know, there was no humidity-controlled environment for all these things, and it's very humid. It was a monsoon. I mean, you know, and think of decades of monsoon weather, and these have just been bound up with string. These were like ledger books, you know, and stored in, you know, not even in boxes. I mean, they were just stored on shelves where mice were running around, rats, probably, you know, snails and insects. And, you know, it's like a cartoon. You take the book off the shelf and blow the dust off, and the dust is a cloud that envelops you, like, you know, a cartoon. And the you know, I was given a knife to separate the pages that might be stuck together. But I thought when he gave me the knife that I was supposed to stab any mice that or rats that might intrude on the research. I really did. I mean, because it wasn't. It was presented sort of as if, like, you know what to do with this. And, you know, I looked around and I thought, oh, no, I don't know if I can defend myself with this. But then it was explained, oh, it's for cutting the pages. But I think the real problem, you know, is you need I needed a magnifying glass a lot of the time to read this incredibly tiny print that had faded, you know, over the years. And the problem really, though, was of organization, because all these records had been kept, but they hadn't been kept organized. And there were just all these, you know, they'd fill a ledger with information and then put it on the shelf and then start another ledger. And sometimes it would have the dates and the Gregorian calendar, and sometimes the dates would be on the Nepalese calendar, which is completely different. And years are different, months are different, everything is different. And it was a translation problem sometimes of just figuring out what numbers we're dealing with here, what years. I mean, that took a lot of time. But then I think the secret was to find threads that were ones that you could follow and where the dates worked and where you seemed to be following a sequence that was chronological, and you could tell by certain things when it actually happened. And then, it was sort of like assembling the pieces of a puzzle by following a particular accountant or a particular record keeper who seemed to be more organized than the others, because some of them were just random. I mean, there were just pages that were full of writing that weren't dated, that referred to obscure things. And it was a needle in a haystack. I mean, it really was a needle in a haystack. And I was looking for references to one name, essentially. And that pretty much became what a lot of it was, is trying to find the right period of dates, because these archives encompass more than a century, find the right period, and that took two or three visits just to get the ledgers that were for the right time. And just going through, looking for a couple of different names, looking for the Jung Bahadur Rana, who was the host, and then looking for Nigel Halleck. And finally, I found a couple of references to Hillock, which had to be Halleck. It wasn't spelled right, but how many Englishmen with that kind of name could have been there at that time? It had to be him. And that was the big revelation. I mean, it was Eureka,
Yeah, no, it was really exciting reading that, because there's a point where in Nepal, you're trying to find information, and you're staying with people, and it seems like, just reading the book, that you're like really concerned that you're gonna sort of lose the trail of Nigel. And then you start getting information from these really interesting sources. So you go to the archive and you find it, and then your friend Boris, can you talk about Boris, because he gives you all this information, or at least tries to be this sort of maybe spy or information node in this network of Nepalese politics and Indian politics, but also Russian politics to a certain extent.
Well, Boris was someone who was continuing to play the great game in the 20th century, essentially. I mean, he saw everything that I shared with him about Nigel, and what he was able to piece together about Nigel from his own knowledge, through a specific lens, and that lens was that of a player of the great game. He'd never heard of Nigel, but as I presented what information I was coming up with, he immediately had a theory, and that theory was that Nigel was a secret agent who'd been sent by the British to ensure, like a deep cover agent to ensure that Nepal stayed within the British orbit, and if they were veering out of it, that he would relay this information back to Calcutta. And, Boris had a great theory. I don't really think. I think it was colored by all his preconception. I think it was a great story, and he was a great storyteller. He, as a young man, he had fought the Bolsheviks. He was a white Russian of an aristocratic family in Odessa, and then he joined the ballet as a strategy to get out of to go into hiding because he was a wanted man once the Reds took over, but the Reds appreciated culture and maintained cultural institutions to entertain people and to keep the upper classes somewhat happy as they went about proletarianizing the rest of the society. And so he went into hiding essentially as a ballet dancer, which enabled him eventually to get out of the country and go to Paris, where he became an accomplished dancer. He was part of the Ballet Russe. He was friends with Diaghilev, Anna Pavlova, Messiaen, these great ballet artists. He was part of that scene. He knew, and he knew Matisse, Cézanne. He's an amazing man. And he eventually, you know, got out of the ballet business and went to India and started a social club in Calcutta, where he immediately became friends with all the aristocratic Indians and the leaders of British society as well. He was a raconteur, you know. He was a tiger hunter. Mm-hmm. He had all these amazing talents. He led this amazing life, and he helped bring about the restoration of the monarchy of Nepal and the overthrow of the Rana family descended from Jung Bahadur. And as a result of that, he was given a palace in one of these palaces that the Ranas had constructed in Nepal, and invited to open the country to tourism and start the first hotel in the history of the kingdom. No one had been allowed in Nepal for 100 years, more than 100. No foreigners had been allowed. Suddenly, in 1951, the idea was, let's have tourism. Let's build up the economy. And Boris was the man to do it. But high-end tourism. They didn't want backpackers. You know, they didn't want, you know, the people that ended up coming. They wanted rich people. And so he was given this palace and did all these things, like grew the first strawberries in Nepal, installed the first flush toilet, you know, like amazing, you know, stories. But the thing was, Boris was a player. I mean, he knew everybody that was important. Everybody knew who he was. He had been involved in the restoration of the monarchy. He knew all the Ranas. You know, he was the ideal person to get information from. I mean, everyone referred me to Boris because he knew there weren't books. You know, you couldn't go into the British Library, or the American Council Library there, the American Library, and just go to the shelves and find out the history of Nepal or find out what was really up with the Ranas. There weren't books. There was not information. You had to go to someone like Boris, who knew kind of where all the bodies were buried. And, you know, he was invaluable because he was really the first person who took an interest in what I was looking into, and he immediately made all these immediate judgments. No, he couldn't have been killed on a tiger hunt in the Terai, which was a family legend, because if he had been, I'd know about it. And he was right, you know. I mean, he was right. He would have known about it because that was the kind of thing that would have been handed down the generations, that kind of a story. And he was a tiger hunter. He was the most acclaimed tiger hunter in India for a long time. So he knew what he was talking about. And, you know, and he said, and he's not buried in the British cemetery, because I go to the British cemetery on my afternoon walk every day because I'm going to be buried there. And I know the names on all the tombstones. It was great. It was a shortcut to, you know, finding out all sorts of things. But mostly it was great as I learned more about Nigel and followed up with some of these Rana people who were descendants of Jung Bahadur. I would go back to Boris and repeat to him what I was finding out, and he would put pieces together in ways I could not. But as I said, he definitely had a conception of the puzzle picture he wanted to see. So he often put the pieces together to form his theory. I think his theory was informed by his own romantic involvement in the Rana history, but you know, he was very helpful and he was a joy. You know, you could listen to this guy talk for hours. I mean, you know, books could be written about the adventures of Boris. And the thing is, I thought a lot of it was, you know, BS when he was talking about this stuff. It was only years later when I started researching the book that I discovered everything was true. the paint, working with Matisse, working with Stravinsky, you know, acting in a film with Jean-Paul Belmondo, all this was true. And Boris, you know, just talked about this stuff as if, you know, everybody had these kind of experiences. And you have, you know, I thought at the time, he's got to be exaggerating, you know, this is impossible. But, you know, it's true. It was all true. So this was somebody that, you know, I wanted to put the original draft of the book had a lot more Boris in it. There's quite a bit now. But, you know, that's one of the problems with writing a book like this, is when you find these amazing characters like Boris, you just want to, that's the novelist problem, is you find a great character and the history goes to the side. You know, as a historian would stick to the script, you know. The novelist is like, finds a character and wants to run with the character. So I had to rein that in, and my editors helped, you know. Henry Lawrence's wife, Honoria Lawrence, was another one. I could have written chapters about her. She was fascinating, but she was kind of, you know, not the main point.
Mm-hmm. Keith, well, you know, we're kind of running out of time, but can we Do you think we can reveal what happened to Nigel, or do you think the reader should pick up the book and read it for themselves?
You know, James, I've gone around and around with the people at Harcourt about this, because the British publishers are much more circumspect about the book, revealing what happens in the promotion and stuff. And they took the timeline out, which Harcourt wanted, because the timeline, if you read the timeline, tells what happens. Mm-hmm. I have to say, I really prefer the reader to experience it rather than talk about it, because the whole point of the mystery, you know, and the quest is finding out exactly what happens. And if you let people know ahead of time, I think it kind of ruins it.
Sure.
Does that make
sense? Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. I think this will be a rare instance where we do a history book and we can't actually tell people what happens.
Well, you know, if you insist, but...
No. I think we should... I honestly agree. I think we should let the readers find out for themselves. But I want to know what you're working on now. Like, what's your new project, Keeper? Are you writing another novel, or you're going to work on history, or what are you going to do?
Well, I have a novel that I stopped working on when I started writing Empire Made. And I've got that back on my desk, and I'm looking through it. And it's really a kind of a suspense story set in London, involving a plot to assassinate the Dalai Lama. But I'm also interested in possibly writing a book, a nonfiction book, about one of the characters in the book is John Nicholson, you know, the hero of the Indian Mutiny. And he, one of the points made in the book is that he actually acquired godlike status among a cult of Indians who believed he was an incarnation of Vishnu and, you know, worshipped him much to his distress through his life. And I started, it's really quite interesting, and it actually survived as a cult until the 1980s in remote parts of the Northwest frontier, according to archival stuff in a Pakistani library I came across. But this got me interested in, I know about cargo cults, and I started getting interested in, I wonder how often this has happened where, you know, some stranger, you know, has become revered and even worshipped. And I know there's a group of people in the South Pacific Island who worship the Duke of Edinburgh essentially, and that's come to my attention. So for reasons that are pretty obscure, but anyway, I'm interested in developing the idea of, if I can find some more examples like Nicholson and Prince Philip, that might make a pretty interesting book. And it would be lots of historical research. So that's on the plate, I think.
Yeah, but, it's interesting. And I think that if you wanted to do this, you could close the gap between empire and, you know, our own lives. Because so many people have their celebrities that they follow. And, you know, they get kind of peculiar. You know, like if you follow Twitter, people just love celebrities. And they, you know, there's always these celebrity stories of, you know, rabid fans and people that have really just, you know, lost connection with reality. And I think that may be something that's sort of universal in human experience or comes up often enough that you might be able to do some work with that.
Yeah, that's exactly how I think of it. In terms of these are the celebrities of their various eras for one reason or another. And they didn't have Twitter and they didn't have Facebook and all this technology, but word spread, you know, through the grapevine or whatever, and somehow it got people obsessed with these people for one reason or another, and some amazing stories result. And I think it's pretty interesting. And you're right. I think it's a reflection of a universal human quality, not just something tied to like primitive societies or the conjunction of an advanced society and a so-called less advanced. It's a universal human desire to objectify someone and among some people, you know, and have someone fulfill a need that for something greater than ordinary life. And I find it very fascinating. The Nicholson thing really fascinated me. Some of his followers actually killed themselves when he died.
Oh, wow.
I mean, you know, because they wanted to join him in his Christian heaven that they knew he believed in. It's amazing.
Wow. No, that's really interesting. That sounds like what I would work on if I was you.
I like to pursue this. I want to find some more examples, you know, and I think I can find them. I'm just reaching the point where I'm ready to start researching again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it takes a while. You have to kind of give it a second. Keith, well, I think we've taken enough of your time. I want to thank you for joining us, and I hope everyone reads Empire Made.
You're really welcome, James. I'm so grateful for the opportunity to talk about it. And, you know, the book took a long time to write, and it's all a very lonely process, so it's really interesting to finally have it connect with people. And I appreciate your thoughtfulness and your interest in this. I really do. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much.